Broadcasted live. Catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.
Thank you so much for staying with us. As I said, we're going to have a full panel. We're discussing the suit today. And so I have in studio with me two guests. We'll start there and we'll then continue with other people as well who'll be joining this conversation. But in studio with us, I have what I would call a Ken Temba scholar, Dr. Sipiwe Mahala, and a writer and a publisher, Zuki Savana, and both of them in studio with me. Good evening and welcome to you both, and thank you so much for making it into the studio.
Good evening. Thanks for having us.
Sukisa, how are you?
I'm fantastic. How are you?
It's always good to see you. Thank you so much for coming through.
Our pleasure.
It's, yes. You've got us talking a lot today about Ken Temba. So I want you to play. Did you get to see the play, Sukisa?
Yes, I watched it yesterday.
You did? Okay. Mm. What was your, just quickly, your reflections on the play?
Well, I thought it's brilliant. Mm. I've seen different variations of the play.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the first time that I got to see the original version, which featured two of the original cast. As you know, the play was first performed in 1993. So it was great to see Brasillo alongside Ndade Job Kubazi, performing exactly the original version.
Suki, so your take?
I absolutely truly enjoyed seeing it. I think I had seen the one in Makanda when it was still Grahamstown.
Mm-hmm.
So it was absolutely nice to see it. It was a different take. It was very refreshing, and it was obviously the conversation afterwards with Ntatesilo telling us that this was how initially it was, you know, when Bonnie Simon directed it. Am I giving away too much stuff that you should be saying later?
Yeah, but also know that the version that we saw in Makanda. Back, it was a Peck Horse production.
Yes,
not featuring.
It didn't have him.
Yeah,
it didn't have him. So it was nice to be able to compare.
Interesting.
And yeah.
So Silamaka Gangube is also here, who is currently the lead on the play, currently playing at the Job. No, it's at the Nelson Mandela Theatre on the Square. And welcome to Point of View. Thank you so much for being here. Are you settled?
I'm settled. I mean, I had just come to listen to these intellectuals.
Not at all. That's why you're here.
You know what's the definition of intellectuals?
Mm-hmm.
Intellectuals are people who go study things that people do naturally.
that would be true. I'm just a writer.
So you did this how many years ago now?
30 years ago. I mean, more than 30. I think the first time as the historian
93-ish.
Yeah, but the significance of 2004 is the fact that Brasillo won the Darro Award, which was the biggest award at the time, for his role as Philemon in the suit.
Revisiting this time, the play must be very different. You're older, you're maturer, you've got some life experience under your belt. I find reading it over time, it makes you see it differently all the time.
Yeah. No, definitely. Because, I mean, when I did it the first time, I was 34,
You were just happy to get a job.
you're happy to get the job, but also you're driven by youthfulness and virility. So your view of the world, you know, it's testosterone driven. And but now, I think, you know, doing it now, 30 years later, I'm sasa material, you know. And, you know, I mean, I'm not as virile as I used to be, you know. And, you know, and again, also doing it with a younger person, you know what I mean? So I think to inspire my performance in a different way, I actually don't look at the relationship from us as equals.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at it as if like it's my, you know, my, what is it, my, what do they call it? My reality, because I'm married to a younger woman. So looking at it from, you know, from that perspective, then I start, you know, in involving kind of like thoughts of what age does to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, when I look at the infidelities, mm-hmm. like, is it because of my virility, you know, mm-hmm. and then, you know, and that kind of like feeds my performance in a totally different way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll start with you, Zuki. So you responded to Spiro's response. The suite continues. And we'll come to him now about what inspired him. But what inspired you to respond to his writing?
Well, you know, I'd read the suit, as I think every writer in this country and every person who loves literature has.
Mm.
And I remember the first time it was in an anthology for Silo and Pasano Mpa.
Mm.
And I remember reading that. I remember reading his response, and
yes.
I thought, well, this is so male, isn't
yes.
it? Nobody felt that. You know, nobody felt that Matilda should have a voice. And it was like late at night, and then I thought to myself, you know what, I'm going to sit, I sat on my computer and I said, I'm going to do a response.
Yes.
But I needed to see how I could do it in a clever way, because Matilda is speaking from the grave.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we do that?
Mm.
So then I wrote it as a letter.
Yes.
You know, dear Phil, by the time you get this letter.
Yes, the suicide note type thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I did it. I finished the first draft and I went to sleep.
Mm.
I saved it and I went to sleep. And then I woke up in the morning and then I read it, and I have never changed a word
really?
Of that first draft.
Mm.
That's the only thing that I've ever written
and
published with the first draft.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah, that's a big thing.
Mm.
Spiro, your response to the suit, you're a Kentemba scholar, as I said, and I think there's a lot that we've learned about Kentemba from your writings. What inspired the suit continues?
Well, first of all, I'm a Kentemba scholar today because of the suit.
Yeah.
It's a story that once you read, stays with you.
It stays with you.
You know, so it haunted me a great deal after reading it. And
Go back. Because you came across it because people were sort of accusing you for maybe plagiarizing it a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I had written a story called Mbumi's Assignment, published in 2001.
Mm.
So I presented that story in 2002 at Vets.
Mm.
You know, so they said, this reminds me of the suit.
Mm.
Basically, what happens there, the wife finds an earring in the bedroom and asks the husband, whose earring is this? Because it's not mine.
Mm.
And he says, it's mine. And then she says, okay, if it's yours, put it on. And this guy happens to be a school principal.
And go to school
so
with
he
it.
To, go to work. You know? So they always said, this reminds me of the suit.
Mm.
And then I went back to the suit, read it over and over again.
Mm.
But after writing it so many times, I realized that there's a story that's not being told there.
Mm.
That if the suit is about adultery,
mm-hmm.
What happens to the adulterer, the man who gets away? The last time we hear about him is that a man clad in vest and underwear was seen
running down the street.
You know, and that's it. So I try to reimagine now the journey of that man from after jumping that window, what happens? And then the story was born.
It was a compliment. Nobody was accusing you of anything. It was a compliment.
And later I realized, yeah.
And I suppose then you were hooked. You wanted to know more.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, after having written that story, so many papers were written comparing my work with that of Kentemba. And I tried to, you know, people assumed that I knew something about Kentemba. Mm. So I started researching, and there was no definitive study of Kentemba, and there was certainly no biography of Kentemba.
Mm.
And I was fortunate that at the time I had interactions with the likes of Exia Mphahlele, Louis Ngosi, and Brawuli Khosile, with whom I worked closely.
Mm.
And they always talked about Kentemba. So I started, you know, catching here and there. until I decided to record them. And this was after the passing of Louis Ngosi.
Mm.
I realized that these stories are getting lost.
Mm.
So I started recording them, spoke to Brawil Hosile, Don Matera, Nadine Godima, all of these people.
Mm.
And that's how my PhD happened.
I'm going to take a quick break and I'll be back with more and the director of the suit currently on at the square, the Nelson Mandela Square, at Theatre on the Square, and we'll continue this conversation. You're more than welcome to be a part of it. 086-000-00959. That's where you can dial in, or you can send a voice note to 063-688-0959. We're discussing the suit and we're now joined also by the director at the moment, Jefferson Shabalala, who's in studio with us as well. Hi, Jeff. Good evening and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, and good evening to all your listeners.
It must have been tough directing Silo.
What do you mean?
Quite the contrary, actually. Quite the contrary. I think...
on a serious note, I mean, was it an obvious decision?
Absolutely.
Okay.
An absolute no-brainer. For young playwrights, for young theatre makers... to be in a room with people who've been doing this for as long as you've been alive, to tackle work that has become seminal in South African literary canon, that kind of opportunity doesn't come about every day. So to take it on is an absolute pleasure, and it's a no-brainer to do it.
And does it come with the kind of pressure, Sulla would say, working with Bini Simon? Everybody in the theatre space will refer to Bini Simon as the icon.
Right, absolutely. Right.
So does it come with that kind of pressure where you think, sure, you know, I've got to match that, or at least not even, because also this is seminal work, right? You can't mess this up.
Exactly. I think that's the beautiful thing about, like, creative relay. Mm. When people set a high standard, it allows you to look up to that standard. It allows you to feel like, what is my interpretation and my twist and my contribution to the thing that's already established? And we were speaking earlier to the writers who responded to that. Imagine the audacity to write to Ken Temba. But that's what we need, the audacity to say, I actually can take this on.
Yeah.
I have a perspective that I think is fresh. I have an idea that I think can add on to what this work is already about, because each artistic offering is an invitation to other artists to interrogate, to prod, to respond, to be inspired by it. So other people might respond in song, others might write another play, others might do a poem, others might make the play like this production is of the short story. So I welcome that challenge. I welcome that those nerves of coming into something that's already this established, so that I can have sleepless nights about how do I do it in a way that honors how it's been done.
That audacity, I mean, you speak directly to Ken Temba in your response. I mean, it's not just a story about a guy who leaves in an underwear. You just say, you know, that bloody Ken Temba. I mean, how does he treat me like this as a character, right?
I guess that's what you do when you're still young. This was 22 years ago.
I wondered about that, whether your response to the play would it be the same now?
Well, I don't know.
Maybe we must challenge you to write another response to the short story.
Yeah, well, I think for me, what helped really was working with people who are quite experienced, because whenever I write anything, I share it with someone. For instance, I wrote a manuscript in 2016, shared it with Brasillo, and then he said, I want to work to act in this. And I thought he was playing with me. But he said, on condition that you make it a one-man play. You know?
Really?
And a one-man play is a real
it's
challenge.
Huge.
It's huge, because you have one person on stage for the whole hour. You know, so I said, okay, I'll live up to the challenge. I rewrote it as a one-man play, gave it to him.
I thought it was your punishment to him.
No, I was punishing him.
And he acted Ken Temba in The House of Truth.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
Yeah, so that basically kicked off my career as a playwright now.
Yeah. So would you write it, would you choose that kind of response now, responding to the suit?
Well, I never chose it even then. You know, it just came to me. And
so what prompted your response to the suit?
what prompted Environmental Response was really to identify a gap and to start thinking. I mean, it haunted me.
Yeah.
I remember I was a student at VS at the time.
Mm.
Yeah.
And as I was walking, unlike Zuki, I did not write it in one day.
Mm-hmm.
I remember walking from the lecture halls back to my room. I would imagine Sophia Town and everything.
Mm.
You know, my world changed. I was living in the 50s.
Yeah.
And I was in that mode until I finished writing the story.
I mean, I think perhaps we also don't give enough space and time to Ken Temba's, I suppose, his time and affection for the space, the socioeconomic situations there. The suit has other interesting elements, but I mean, from the word go, there's commentary about the social environment, the economic situation, the political situation in a big way.
Mm.
And it hits you from the minute he starts the play, which for me is quite powerful.
Mm. No, it certainly is. I mean, it certainly is. I mean, for me, I mean, he you know, like the one moment where, I mean, just after he's, oh, no, be even, yeah, just after he's finished washing up. You know, and he says these things. He says this.
These things that we do for.
No, not that one yet. No, this, the one when he says that this whatever was thorough, though no white men complain.
Yes, after when, no, I can tell you exactly where.
Yeah.
It's when he's washing himself in his private parts. And he makes the point that no white man has ever mastered this art.
Yes,
he doesn't.
He just says that white people always think that black people stink. You know, and they don't know how thoroughly we wash. You know. And then and then after making breakfast to his wife, you know, and he says, you know, these things that we blacks want to do for our own, not fawningly for the whites for whom we bloody well got to do it.
Mm.
You know. So, you know, and he makes very interesting commentaries.
Yeah.
You know, social and political commentaries.
Yeah, I think that the story is deeply political, but his politics are not overt.
No, of course.
Like, he'll talk about, for instance, a man going to, trying to use
a toilet,
bathroom.
Yeah.
And
then,
exactly.
And there are 30 other households in the yard.
Exactly. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So he's given you the situation in this society.
Yeah.
You know, and also, I mean, before the bus... bascule scene, you know, where he says all the township news, you know, will be generously reported and spiritedly discussed by the bus at large, you know, and he talks about what is it? Gosh, how can I, you know? Like,
there's also the relocation of Sophia Town at that spot.
Exactly.
At that
conversation. You know. So, I mean, he says, I mean, whatever, how they viewed the world, you know. I mean, white people, you know, the white bosses, they were scurrilous. You know, the government was rude. And Ghana and Russia. You know, idolatrous. You know, America in the West, sympathetically ridiculous. You know, and so, it just shows how the politics haven't really changed.
So, Jeff, you added some nice color in this particular installation, and I thought that's interesting. It's a little bit of Hitler there. That was nice, and it must be tough adding your own color in a play that was already so beautifully written.
Exactly, man. And it's with like audacity and humility that you do that. It's like you kind of have to invite yourself as a co-author.
Yes.
You respect the primary author and you think to yourself that like Dr. Sue was talking about, like, it's 62 years on.
Yeah.
And we are looking at the pulse of the now. And this lens of then, how vivid it is, even in the now, is so deep. And like, when you dive into this work, we talk out now about the sociopolitics of it all, but the candor, the humor, the manner in which he made it human, right? Like, he doesn't speak truth to power and then dehumanize the people who do it.
Mm-hmm.
The level of protest is not about, this is us shouting on the street. It's about the daily existence is to protest this thing that's against us. And we find nuggets of life in a situation that doesn't want us to live or breathe.
Why did Zukiswa Matilda have to live on for you? Why did you feel she had to explain her side of the story?
I think it was important for me because I wanted to look at the at the space that women in Sophia Town had at that time. You know, when Spiro wrote that he didn't realize that she was married, my immediate response was, well, women in Sophia Town couldn't own housing at that time, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, you've got... Philemon is very cultured, you know, and I wanted to respond to that. I wanted to respond to, oh, this man who expects me to have learned a new English word when he's come from work, you know, this lawyer. And then I think one of my favorite, my particular favorite part is where she says that Philemon would say to her, she looks like the Greek goddess Athena, and the only Greek goddess she knows is the only Greek she knows is the butcher's wife, and who's whatever. And then she goes on further and she says, but this guy, this Dolly, other guy, he says, I look like Dolly Ratajkowski in pin-up magazines. And you know, sometimes a girl just wants to be Dolly.
But she also says other things, like, you know, we speak about these heavy topics.
Yeah.
I just want to be a woman. I just want to be a girl. I just want to be loved differently.
Yeah. Exactly.
I want to experience life differently.
Absolutely. And I mean, obviously, there is that thing where she's talking about how having conversations with women at where they're fetching water. And this was a key thing because they didn't have a tap by her house. So, you know, she's going and she's communal water gathering, and then she's hearing things about what the men do in bed. And she's like, it has never happened like that with Phil.
to Silla's point, she was young.
Yes.
You know, and you make that point quite clearly in your response. She was young, and clearly life was interesting. She was beginning to see life and herself starting to mature into this marriage where the man is fine, but she's exploring. She wants to see, feel, do things that society has not allowed her to do.
Absolutely.
I'm going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll take your calls on 086-000-00959.
Hi, Ospimelo. Very interesting conversation with the team there. Linna, after listening to everything that they've said, Linna will be seen pa before the suit closes.
All right, we continue our conversation around the suit. So let's talk about the suit itself. I know that Makosazana Klaba had responded to you as well. And I think it's the suit behind the suit. That's the name. That's the title, I think, of her.
Yes, actually, it's two reimaginations, Behind the Suit, and The Suit Continued, The Other Side.
Yes. And so, Jeff, I mean, again, there's all the other living characters, and then there's this living character, which is the suit. For me, quite a big character in the play. Your treatment of that?
I think the grandness of the metaphor is one of the reasons that story is so iconic. This all of us have an omnipresent being in all our lives. Either it's a cup, either it's an heirloom, either it's someone's garment. But this one is not meant to be in this house, and it's now kept in this house. And I think the manner in which Ken treated this suit, it has a bigger life than even Philemon and Matilda. It hovers in the walls of that home, in their everyday conversation, in their every meal. And I think it's also like such a really deeply powerful metaphor about what trauma looks like. It can cling to you. And he made, like, Philemon literally makes his pain manifest in a garment. And that garment is not even just the representation of the infidelity, but it's a representation of what intrusion looks like when a trust bond is broken. It's like you've let something into something that is sacred of ours. So I will deepen its entry into our home by putting it in our bed, by putting it on our table where we eat. So that invasion that you have created toward me, I will retaliate and create it too toward you. And to witness that level of pain and vulnerability, because there's a lot of interpretations that see Philemon as this conniving, very evil person. There's very little time where we see him as a vulnerable human being who is just playing he's playing out his pain.
Mm.
Like he has been deeply hurt and he only knows how to respond by doing that. So I think that suit is very sacred.
So, you know, obviously there's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes in how you interpret what you're going to do with the piece. And for you, how did you personify the suit for yourself in how you wanted to engage with it, in how you wanted to internalize it?
You know, for me, I think it was more what Ken Temba has done.
Mm.
You know, I mean, the way he just starts the story, I mean, this guy is 5:30 in the morning, and the very first thing he does, said when he wakes up, he doesn't even want to wake his wife.
Mm.
You know, he crawls out, you know, and even before he does anything else, and as he step out of the room, he doesn't even go quack, quack, quack.
Mm.
He tiptoes.
Mm.
And then before then, and then he looks at her.
Mm.
And to her, she's a morning miracle.
Mm.
You know, I mean, Ken Temba uses a very big word, matutinal. You know.
Careful parastasis.
Careful parastasis. You know what I mean? I mean, and this is what this man is.
Yeah.
You know, and he goes, he wakes up, makes fire, you know, and after making fire, he makes breakfast, you know, and he, you know, and he goes and brings the breakfast and he wants even to wash up, you know, and. And then the next thing he hears, there's somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Ken's response to that is just mind-blowing. I mean, that verse where he says, it was not like the explosion of a devastating bomb.
Mm.
It was more like the critical breakdown in an infinitely delicate piece of mechanism.
Mm.
And at the end, and you saw the delicateness, you know, when you know when the play started, and I mean this man, I mean, and he says, "What is it? Molten, viscous, molten metal was creeping upon the fuel tanks, and you know, and Philmon had gears grinding and screaming. I mean, you can imagine. And for me, it was basically bringing that to life, you know, and bringing it to life in such a way that it is not." You know, sometimes we act and we never allow things to basically just emerge out of us, you know, and your breath and everything just, it is just married into what you are saying and in your walk and in everything. And when you actually in real life, when you are experiencing something, your whole body basically lives the pain, lives the either the everything.
Mm.
And I think that is what I wanted to, you know, to live that experience.
You know, Sukisa, I think you were joking about the language. You guys were, you know, the elaborate English. For me, it works very well with the suit itself and why it's not a cup, as Jeff was saying, and it's a suit. I think for me, representing quite an interesting element of the writer, Ken Temba, who I think, you know, we forget what era he comes from.
Yeah.
Yes.
Where he himself idolized English and...
Got distinction, and
the difficulty of seeing this man who was so African and yet so European at the same time. Why the blue itself, a color that is of very, very colonial kind of, for me, references, and a suit. Why the suit was so important to him, I think says a lot about the man himself, too, who they say didn't speak much African languages.
He didn't speak any African languages.
I think he did, but kind of was very snobbish about it. That's my take.
I don't understand it. I don't speak it.
he was snobbish. Okay.
Very snobbish
of the time.
I think he was above that.
He was above Model C.
You must understand that this is a man who studied at the University of Fort Hare. Pre-Bantu education, he was a royal reader. And passed English with a distinction. And, you know, interestingly, this is a point that I raised the other day, that this year marks his centenary. He would have been 100. And there are two other centenarians from Fort Hare, that is Dennis Brutus and Robert Sobukwe. So they are the same generation from Fort Hare. And you can see the products from that generation, everything that they do, whatever field they choose in life, they excel.
Again, to the suit itself, your thoughts on the suit that he picks as quite an iconic piece of an item that is central to this entire story.
Yeah, actually, it was central to me too, because what I tried to do was to develop the character of the suit, it a sentimental value. To say this is...
Was it a wedding day?
It's his wedding suit. It's his wedding suit. And also in the same suit, his pass is in the suit. As you know, that a black man is reduced to nothing without a pass. Mm-hmm. And also his house keys were in the suit, you know.
And the wallet.
Yes. You know, so that's part of developing the character of the suit.
Yeah.
And I think this is... where you realize, you know, how brilliant Ken Temba is as a writer to develop such a classic story out of a piece of cloth, a garment.
Mm. 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 And you thought as well that the suit would be the one way in which you could extend this seminal work?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's so much you can derive out of the suit. It says a lot about the character. Mm. Like, I teach the stories at Wits. Mm. Actually, all the four stories, Zuki Swa's, mine, Kwesi Tshaba's, and Ken Temba's.
Mm.
So what is interesting is that Zuki Swa's take, the title itself, it says the dress that fed the suit.
Yes,
you know, what does the dress represent?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there is so much you get in terms of the meaning beyond what is presented to us.
Mm. Yeah. Just to quickly touch on Kwesi's piece, I mean, she speaks about the story behind the filament that we get to experience.
Presenting a choir perspective.
Yeah.
So it makes you know a great connection when you have Ken Temba's The Suit, which is focalized on Philemon, and you have My The Suit Continued, which is told from the perspective of Terence, who is an unreliable narrator. And then
Terence, who you give the name Terence, because he doesn't have the name Terence.
Yes.
You give him another name,
KK.
Right?
No. I call him Terry because I'm directly responding.
Yes.
Yeah, you know. But also about the play, it's interesting that how these characters are juxtaposed. That we meet Ndade Maphikela, who is lying in bed expecting his wife to do everything for him, and then we move to Philemon's house.
Mm-hmm.
Where he actually gets up to do everything for his wife.
Mm. KK, for you, Jeff?
I think like that's like a thorn in every life. Everyone in their life has been a KK or has been KK. and I think it's those kind of complications in life that like mold who we are, right?
Yeah.
So the thing happens and then who you become is your response.
Mm.
Like these writers respond to each other, but in real life, we write our performance in real life.
Yeah.
And I think... And the fact that like KK in this world appears for that one scene and just changes. We only witness this person visiting once. And the change and the trajectory that the story takes on after this one visit just really, in the play, crystallizes what one moment can do for someone's entire life.
Mm. So what for you, as you were working through Philemon, was his backstory for you?
For me, he was just this. I think he was a self-made man, and a guy who basically chose that he's going to live his life in a certain way against what was the norm.
Mm.
And in fact, Ken writes it that way because he says, you know, he was not the kind who would put his wife in a place even though he was a good wife.
Mm.
So he had actually observed the environment and said, but no, I'm not going to treat my woman this way.
Mm.
So I think that for me, that's, you know, I always say that if it is not in the script, it is not in the play. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And because writers actually sit down and make sure that they create, they say he does this, and they create a whole picture.
Mm.
And your duty as an actor is actually to I think, to breathe life, you know, into those words that are just on the page and give them meaning and voice and even an understanding, you know. But one thing also for me about the suit, I think Ken Temba was saying, let's have
a conversation. Agenda. I think so too. I also think it was way ahead of his time.
Yeah.
I
mean, absolutely.
When you look at the role of women, I think there's lots of commentary there where he says, this is what's happening. This is my take on what is happening. And do you not think it's problematic?
And this is 1963.
Can you imagine?
Yes. You know. So for me, I mean the whole thing that, well, they say he was punishing the woman with this. It says, we've got something here. Let's talk.
And he's making us talk to this day. He's forcing us to reflect on that to this day. Because I think, I also think that in a way, we have to consider, as I said, the time. And how, in fact, it was normal back then to be abusive. He could have been abusive in all kinds of ways. Yes, we speak about it psychologically and all of that, but I also think he was quite delicate in how he gave Philemon this quite interesting, I suppose, psychological torture himself.
He actually says, you know, I mean, when he, you know, Philemon was decent about it, he even gave extra money for it.
Yeah.
You know, of course, he knew nothing of the castigation that he, of the strain that he himself suffered from his castigation.
Yeah.
And for me, that's another thing that Philemon has actually hasn't spoken.
Yeah.
In that whole story, he hasn't spoken.
Actually,
do you know what I really liked in the play, though? I liked how you guys added, like, after the whole drama, because in the story, it's just where he has, he goes and he goes and he gets drunk and he comes and he sees the houses, whatever.
Yeah.
But the way you guys added with and Tatema Pikela and all those guys now, like, saying,
Forgive.
So I like that. Like, that was such a beautiful breath of life to it as well, I think.
And that the community is not just onlookers. They themselves have added their voice to... We may not respond, but they are invested in this life.
Also, one of the clues in understanding Philemon's character is the book that he's reading. You know, and I like the fact that
the psychological play, book, right?
Yeah.
Abnormal psychology.
Abnormal psychology.
You know, another nod to the literature also.
Yeah, absolutely. The
you see, that's why she didn't like him with
And that's one of the things he does in the morning. He packs his book.
But you know what I learned about this whole thing of book reading? It was from David Pitt, who played Paul Moroka, his father in Generations. And one thing that he said was that during the Sophia Town days, if you were a guy and didn't have a book, that you were
frowned upon.
You were frowned upon. So guys would always be having a book, you know, to read. So reading was something that was just an in thing.
So if we look at Ken Temba himself and Philemon, I see lots of parallels.
Really?
the alcohol, I think, is because, if I'm right, he never drank until he was a journalist.
Now that you mention it.
The drinking shows up in a situation where the man is dealing with many, many other issues.
Right.
Similarly with Philemon, who I don't think was a drunk.
He'd never been inside that ship.
Yes. Until trouble knocks at his door. In a way, for me, I think Ken Temba recognized his own demons in portraying Philemon.
Yeah, well, definitely he did recognize his demons. I did not think about it until you mentioned it now. And basically it's something that you pick up in his writing. Brasillo will tell you about The Will to Die, for instance.
Yes.
What he says there, you know, is exactly what is happening to him.
Yeah. Let me take a quick break. I'll be back with more after this. We continue our conversation about the play that's on currently, and that's at the Theatre on the Square in Sandton. I think it's on until when?
The 16th of November.
The 16th of November. So if you want to go and see it, please go see The Suit. I've got a response here. Maybe many of you will recognize the name. Ntikeng Mohlele, who says he's loving clever people speak. Yes. So he says to say hello to you, and he's enjoying the conversation.
Hi, Ntikeng.
Come see the show, Ntikeng.
So, yeah, Ntikeng, come in to watch the show. So, do you think Matilda needed more time in your script? Jeff?
No. No, I think also Ken Temba deliberately marginalized Matilda, even in this short story.
I also feel so.
Yeah.
I do feel that Matilda got the short end of the stick.
And I think...
Mahala, let's leave him. I mean, he completely forgot, you know. Yeah, I also felt we've cheated Matilda.
That's why she needed that redemption, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think it was a good omission. A very provocative omission.
That's what all Ken Temba groupies say, right? Mm. All the groupies, you'll agree.
I'm joining bandwagon.
It's a Ken Temba groupie thing.
Yeah.
As they say in French, I'm adored.
No, they will never criticize Ken Temba.
But also what the play does, it gives a voice. It might not be the most dominating voice in the play, but we do get her perspective, which is not what we get in the short story.
Yes, no, of course. Yeah.
In any case,
I think that's where Bunny was brilliant.
Yes.
And, you know, talking about making sure that you respect the writer's voice.
Mm.
And what he did was basically try within that and try and write something that will still kind of like resonate as if it was, Ken Temba. I mean, Ken Temba writing, you know, Matilda's, voice. And also, you know, the respect. You know, I remember, I mean, when we were reading it in the rehearsal room, we had three stories. We had Crepuscule, and I can't remember the other one. And we read the three of them, and he decided, said, no, let's leave that. We're going to focus on this.
It's like came for so far,
yeah.
The third one was Requiem for Soweto.
Was it the Requiem for Soweto? Okay. Mm. And, but yeah, and he said, no, let's leave all, you know, those two. Let's just focus on this. And from there, it was all about just respecting. And we read the first paragraph and he said, okay, let's keep that there. And then we're going to need something here. Mm. You know, we're going to need something. And that's how, you know, we kind of like went, you know, when we got to Mapikele, he says, oh yeah, we're going to have to get some jokes here. You know, and that's how it was done, you know.
And, you know, I appreciate that I wasn't born when you first performed it. I appreciate that I didn't see it, because I think I would have then written Matilda in a very different way.
Yes. Is it?
So, yeah, exactly. Yes. So I'm glad that I first saw that Matilda when I went to see it yesterday when you performed. Because that was actually quite a nice perspective on Matilda. And it made as much sense as the one that I felt like I'd written. So, I really appreciated
that. She fits your story very nicely.
You know, when I get back on my groupie bandwagon, I think writers need to be selfish about the story and the version they choose to tell.
Of course. Mm-hmm.
And they need to be problematic about what they omit. Mm-hmm. They need to be like, even if it's tongue-in-cheek.
Absolutely.
Even if it's tongue-in-cheek to go, why is it king? I know they're going to look at this and say, and then they and I think what that does, really, there are no responses if the person doesn't make hard and fast decisions.
Absolutely.
There are no interrogations. You'll never find a gap if the person is trying to please all of us. Okay, now it's Matilda's monologue. Actually, I'm going to deal with Philemon in my take. And I'm working in the short story medium, so I've only got this amount of time, and this is the character I am going to focus on for the version of the story I wish to tell. And really...
And he doesn't owe any character anything.
Anything, yeah. Because it's his pen, you know? Like, and he needs to be as visceral and as honest as possible to the thing that he's seeing. And trust that, like, the larger artistic community, should it be provocative enough, will then come and respond. And some of them aren't going to be direct responses. I'm sure... as I read other works from other writers, that these are responses to the suit which are not labeled as that.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Some of these are quite blatant and saying, okay, we are responding to this story. Others, this song by this artist or this, it's exactly this story, but like it's provoking people in different ways and they're responding in their own medium. And you don't get that if someone is not really definitive about this is the story I intend to tell and how I intend to tell it.
I'm going to take a call. Ntata Selby is calling us from Orange Farm. Hello, Ntata Selby.
Hi, Pamela. How are you there?
I'm good. How are you, Ntata Selby?
I'm blessed beyond measure.
Excellent.
The intellectuals, how are you?
So, I'm not responding.
Intellectuals, how are you?
Oh, we are all intellectuals.
Yes. Welcome, Ntata Selby.
Hey, no, yes, Pamela. No, you know, I like plays. I like going to watch plays. Until I realized that I struggle a lot because I want to have the picture of these people in my mind. Mm-hmm. The thin one, I picture him being a fat somebody. The chocolate one, I picture him being a yellow bone.
You write your own story.
I write my own story.
It's very funny, Dr. Selby, because I think people in the studio don't know Dr. Selby is visually impaired.
Oh. Okay.
So it is funny in that way.
I must tell you this story because when I did my matric, I attended school with a guy who was visually impaired. And he became an advocate, but he's passed on now. But again, like Hibukawa, you know, and like now as Noot, you know. But anyway, I think the most interesting part of my story is that, in fact, I came number one, March. You know, but from there on, and like in Asnadi Buka, because I get it, the Braille Prince came late.
Yeah.
But after they came, I was always number two. So,
Oh, Dada Sobi, that's delightful.
Thank you, Dada Sobi.
That's beautiful.
You know, I was going to attend it, but now I'm afraid to picture my own people there, to write my own story.
That's the beauty of the story, Dada Sobi. Come and imagine.
You're on radio throughout.
Yeah.
You're like in theater of the mind.
Thank you, Dada Sobi. Thank you. Thanks, Dr. Selby. So, I mean, that is funny.
That's hilarious.
It is actually funny.
No. He owns it very proudly.
That's beautiful.
So I don't think he takes offense at all. So, you know, I just want to ask, why in your view, all of you, do you think the story has stood the test of time in the way that it has?
Well, for me, it's got all the elements of a
classic
story.
Yeah.
I mean, the way it starts, actually, for classroom purposes, when I teach short stories,
that's the suit.
Yeah. So, finally, that translates to theater as well. Mm. All the elements you need in theater, they are there.
Mm.
You know, the way the story develops from. I mean, him moving from home to the bus station, and then the moment Mapigela tells him, you see the rise in action. You know, it's really amazing. Yeah.
It's okay, sir.
It's just an excellent classic story. It's one of those that really stay with you. I remember yesterday, I don't remember the last time I read The Suit, but I remember yesterday when I was watching the performance, when I kept repeating the words, because
these
lines stay in your head, you know. And if you have something, I think I first read The Suit when I was like maybe like 12 years old. If you have something that stays that long in your mind, always, you know, it's it that just says, you know, you feel like you know, you've seen Tatema Pikela, you know this person. And by the way, and in the short story, he doesn't really have like a lot of space.
No, he doesn't have much.
But what he does, you know, the way he affects everything in that story is just like major.
Silo, your reason you think the story has lasted?
For me, I think it's from... I came across Kentemba when I was almost giving up acting, you know. And when I read The World of Kentemba, I read... I found somebody who was telling stories about, or you know, talking about a life that I could relate to, but also saying, you know, but having written it with such exquisite language. And then now doing The Suit, I mean, I used to prize Woza Albert as an actor's jam. But doing The Suit, just took me to another level, because and I think it took me to the levels of call your Al Pacinos, Jack Nicholson, whatever. And with that, with doing The Suit, I found myself kind of like getting into that league. And I think that role, you know, just has that, you know. And yeah, for me, it is just living the experiences, because I've always seen myself as, I think, a vehicle for characters.
Wait, you wanted to give up acting at the age of 34?
Exactly.
Youth is wasted on the youth.
I know. But yeah, it's that. I think for me, it is just a beautiful story, and the character that Ken wrote, you know, that was it.
Jeff?
I think you spoke earlier about like an anglicized, very Eurocentric, I am of the suit, I am of this ilk of Fort Hare, I am of this English. But then a deliberate care for blackness and black stories. And finding a raising of the caliber of the humans who are otherwise always treated as victims of. All right? And I think what Ken did, which was not fashionable at the time, was to zoom in on a very microscopic story that kind of deletes the larger circumstance of making like the lead, the protagonist black male is not shouting against white people, he's having an internal crisis. I think it resonates and lives age on because this person chose to see people that were chosen not to be seen at that time, and he saw them in grandeur, and he wasn't afraid to talk about the dark parts of them, even in a time where everything about them was trying to be valiant, we're fighting the struggle. He wanted to say, even in this, there are people who are broken, who are miserable, who are trying to patch themselves together, who are trying to find love, who married too early, who have regrets. And he made all those people, people with complex, dynamic, really challenging lives outside of a global situation. And I think that's why it lives on, because it speaks to the human experience in ways that other work of that time was not.
I'm going to take a call. Malitzima is calling from Springs. Hello, Malitzima.
Hi, Asimila. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm fine. I just laughed with you at the silence that you were explaining as that this will be speaking that nobody knew.
They didn't know whether it's funny or whether they should be politically correct.
So, Pimola, I just want to say something honestly. I think I see the world through Kaya FM because Mina, I'm a home church work person. And every Thursday and today listening, it makes me to be lured to go out because I've never went to a play. But like, I grew up watching him. Love his acting. Kaholo, isenghanyani. You know, But the passion that they're talking about in the studio, it makes you to say, Malikuma, you need to live a little. Just go to see a play and just relax. Because it's always mommy versus mommy jet and work and church and everything. But
amen.
My world, I always see it through Kaya FM. I know things through Kaya FM. So for me, just listening to, I'm doing my monthly report, but I'm listening to you. As I said, you really make my life to be so relaxed in the evening, just to forget about a lot of things for a bit and just listen to this beautiful voice and have visitors. I'm grateful. I just want to say that. Oh. And aww. I love all of them in the studio. I love all of you guys. You really make somebody to say, you know what, leave a bit. Go and watch them. And the story that you are telling for me, yeah, I don't know. You just make me to relax, guys. And I say attitude of gratitude to you, Aspimela, and your visitors. Love, love, love you so much.
Thank you.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing you at
She's
the theater.
She's going to be coming. I think she'll bring the whole family.
Yeah. Come on Sunday after church.
Yeah. Bring the church.
So the generational mix in this particular installation, I think for me, is actually what makes this play. I mean, a job, I think, for me is the gem of the play. Sorry, Silo.
I know.
You're the natural star, but I think he really just shines through. And I think he speaks to so many elements that we spoke of. You know, here's a character that actually revealed who Ken Temba is. In as much as we thought he's a snobbish, you know, writer, journalist, scholar, and all of that, he cared about that character.
Yeah.
And says a lot about who he was and what he was trying to reflect in us. Just maybe your experience, Jeff, with working with such a lovely generational mix.
I used to joke in the rehearsals and say, I'm an ageist. This play is very clearly made for the ages they were when they first premiered. And echoing on to the question about what makes it timeless is that it lives now, even in their current bodies, 3 decades later. So you realize that this is actually just about the humans. This is about a senior citizen gentleman who's married a young little thing. This is about people of the same age. This is about an older Matilda. Who's, and I think... I think for me to have firstly the original cast from whom the improvisation and the play and some of the text that is now in this work were their ideas.
I was going to say, it sounds like some of this were peppered by their own inputs.
Exactly. It was their writing, their imagining. And to see them recount in the rehearsal room, I used to say, when you guys did it last week. Because that's what it feels like to them. That 3-decade journey, like they just transport themselves to it like this. Like they'll be doing a blocking. I'm like, oh, how do we solve this? And they go, yeah, what we did was, and I'm like. But without any arrogance for how we're doing it now, without not bringing that up to say this is how we want it, saying that's how we did it, how does it talk to how we want to do it now? And to have people who have an experience longer than your lifetime saying, how do I do this? How do I approach this? Are you happy with this choice that I've made? Then you don't enter a room as a younger person feeling like, I need to prove myself. I actually need to come to the room and just work because I'm here with colleagues. It teaches me now, if I'm working with younger people, how to be. This is how you hand over the baton. This is how you trust other people when you give them a relay. This is how you treat professionals in a room. You don't say, but when I... No, you say, okay, your role is this, and I hand over my decades of experience, and I humble myself to the things that you are going to say and to the way in which you want to run this rehearsal and run this room. So I've been deeply, deeply humbled to learn from them, to take counsel from them, to be challenged by them, to hear some questions that open up my mind to the world of storytelling, and also to be invited to... to see them invite new ideas, invite new challenge, especially as people who know this work, to go, okay, actually, we can go there. We can venture there. And let's even meet you further still. That idea that you've proposed, we are one-upping it by saying this. So I've learned a great deal about how to take care of what mentorship looks like, even in a professional environment.
Solo, you mentioned slightly earlier that it was interesting playing with a much younger co-star as well. And again, that generational mix where you have a co-star who was with you at the very beginning, and here are the younger ones now who are here to, I suppose, bring themselves, but also take a lot of what you have to give from the original script.
No, it really was. I mean, and it's really she's something else. Because I always say to Wena, le godimo, ole soup. There's heaven. It's not where you're going to. But it's just lovely in a sense, like you work with that energy and also. And even working with Cyril, it was so lovely that I didn't even feel older than her. You know what I mean?
And them seeing it through fresher eyes, younger, fresher eyes as you know, actors.
But I'm tempted. You know, Ken, this, the end of the story.
Yeah.
Guys, please. I mean, he says, reeling drunk. That's the last paragraph. He says, reeling drunk late that Sunday, and that is Philemon. He crashed through his kitchen door onwards to his bedroom.
Yeah.
Then he saw her.
Yeah.
They have a way of saying in the argot of Sophia Town, cook eight, cop eight, signifying that someone was impacted with such violent shock that whatever whiffs of alcohol still wandered through his head were instantaneously evaporated, and the man stood sober before stark reality. There she lay, curled as if just before she died. She begged for a little love, implored some impeccable lover to cuddle her a little, just this once, just this once more. Philemon picked her up, circled insanely with her in his arms, and in an intense anguish cried, Tilly.
And I think for me, that brings, you know, that full circle moment. You know, we go through this whirlwind with him. We love him at the beginning. We are this, like, what a wonderful man. You know, where does this angel come from? We resent him immensely. And then we humanize him. He humanizes him a great deal at the end where he himself, you know, he was struggling.
But also, what you notice there is that ending is... It still leaves you with questions there's no mention of suicide.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. We don't know how she died.
It's
her.
In fact, I question that a lot.
That's why I needed to do that.
I question
because
that
I'm like,
why is everybody assuming she killed herself?
No. The reason I did that is because I realized that, like, there was no other way we could have a story from her, since she's already beyond the grave. So the only way I could do that, I was thinking about it, the only way I could do that was as a suicide note, and she gives reasons for doing so. You know, that was the only way it made sense to me.
I didn't think it was suicide.
What did you think it was?
She was robbed.
I think she died of a heartache.
Broken heart.
You guys, you watch too much.
It's Telemundo.
I think so. Ken Temba, how did he die?
Of a broken heart.
Exactly my point. I think she died of a heartache. I think this story parallels so much of Ken Temba's real life.
Also, just to the people who are listening, can I just say that I think Philemon would really, really approve of the way Jeff is dressed.
I am so
Jeff
happy.
Is this, in is yeah.
Jeff is
in
khakis. This is radio. I'm so happy.
Let's take a quick break. I'll be back with more after this. Our conversation continues. We're discussing the suit. Okay, I'll tell you who is in studio. Sidile Makagangube, who is the actor, currently at the theatre on the square. The suit is running. You have Jeff Shabalala, who's a director. Dr. Spio Mahala, who is a Kentemba scholar. And then you've got a writer and publisher, Zugi Svavarna. And she's written a response to what was a response to Spio Mahala's response to the theatre. So, yeah, it comes full circle. So I was saying, I think she didn't commit suicide. But I mean, that the writer allows us that freedom to take it wherever we wanted to
Brilliant
take it.
Brilliant writing.
Yeah, and Zugiswa comes with her own revelations in the dress that fed the suit. Mm. Why that it's suicide and why she committed suicide.
I think if you're a good writer, you know for a fact that you tell them very nice things that are very certain. Mm. And then when they hope for more certainty, just be stingy. Just be stingy. Because then what happens is that they know that when you can be very factual. They know that you can give them information. And what you choose not to give them, that's where the magic is. And also the theater does that as a collaborator of storytelling.
So for the actor who needs to imagine what's happened to her, what did you think happened to her?
Hey,
it's that wailing moment, as you're saying, the writer says, he obviously wailed, and we could all tell, even from the actual story itself, something had shifted. In him, he was moved beyond anything we've ever experienced him and seen him to be.
I mean, I think for me, it's like Philemon after that, he blames himself. You know what I mean? Well, how she died, it's not the point. It's the fact that now he's lost her. You know what I mean? I can't think beyond whether she killed herself or not. No. That is not important. What is important is that I've lost her. And why? Maybe it's because of what I did. You know, and I took, you know, there was a story of a guy who ran away, you know, snatched a bag from a white woman, but he was caught. In court, they say, the judge asked him, what were you doing, dude? And he says, no, I was just joking. And the judge says, you carried the joke too far. You know, so Philemon just carried the joke, the joke too far. You know, and I can imagine him like living a very miserable life after that.
But do you see how then the particular suicide note is a bit of redemption for him? It makes him feel slightly better because she's done this. That's the reason why she. So he's not going to be like, oh my god, you know, whatever. She wasn't that great anyway, Tilly.
And I must say, all of this confuses my students because
great,
they read Kentimba's version and get angry at Philemon what she did, you know, and then they read my version and then get to learn about Terence and get angry at Terence and then they read Zugiswa's version and
she says it's okay. I still love you.
The girls in his class like it.
Of course.
The boys have issues with it.
Tell us.
The stories always divide my classes.
Yes, absolutely. I can imagine. And what's the young people's take on, for instance, Zugiswa's piece?
Most of the time they want to respond. Actually, I've had students writing several responses. Girls obviously feel liberated in a sense
because somebody's giving Matilda a bigger voice and so on.
Yes, and others feel that Philemon was justified to punish her the way she did, the way he did. So it always sparks a lot of debate.
Yeah, these are usually boys who are listening to Andrew Tate.
Also, many debates in a rehearsal room. And because, especially in a process where developing these characters, finding that world, you discover this thing today and you read one line and it changes your mind tomorrow.
Yes.
And you discover this thing today. So today you're sitting with an actor in Sirileto who's like, it is suicide. You're sitting with Cyrilla tomorrow and it's heartache. You're sitting with Cyrilla tomorrow and it's revenge. She wants to
make him suffer.
Yeah, she wants to make him suffer. And she wants. So, like, when you're unraveling all the multiple layers, you're realizing that actually, if you're only going to have a creative view, the death is the device of loss. But in the story, it's like a further deepening of like Philemon's anguish. And to find that, like, if it's a choice on Matilda's part, it's her hand in the game as well. If he says, "I want it like this every day, every night," she says, "I'll take away every night from you. This is the last night you can do this. I hope you had a great time with your friends." So there's multiple reasons why losing her gives the story an incredible gravitas.
Spiro, let's maybe place where Ken Temba was headspace-wise when he was writing the suit.
He was already in Swaziland. Where,
oh gosh, so that was much later.
Yeah,
in his life.
Yeah, he was already in Swaziland, and he sent the story to Nat Nakasa. So, I mean, he went there.
A lot had happened by then in his life.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So he...
Let's just recap for those who don't know his personal stories. He had already had an affair with a white woman. Who was married. Who was married? Tell us.
Because when I was in London, we did the man who... What's it? Who killed Mr. Drum? Yeah, yes, the Silver Stain book. It was dramatized.
Yes.
So I played Ken Temba there. And after the show, one evening, a gentleman, a white gentleman, comes to me and says, "Hi." Is it Maxwell?
I remember the name.
Yeah.
Genesis.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, okay. And he comes and says,
Malcolm Hart.
Malcolm. Yes. And Malcolm comes to me and says, "I'm the man you cuckold."
So quickly, quickly there was Jean.
The name is Jean, but in the story they call her Jane. Yeah, so Jean Hart came to South Africa to reunite with her husband from the UK.
This is now for everybody. This is now the real Ken Temba story.
And then Ken Temba became KK.
Yes,
a party was organized to welcome Jean to South Africa. Organized at Blok Modisani's place, and then Jean met Ken, and they fell in love. And she moved out of her apartment with Malcolm and stayed with Ken
somewhere in Hillborough, I think.
Yes,
writers.
and they have that tragic story themselves because they were not even allowed to be together. Let's just contextualize.
If flew in the face of the Morality Act. You know, so it was a scandalous affair, not only because Jean was a married woman, but also in the context of apartheid at the time.
And obviously he had his own troubles with the government and his papers and his qualifications and his certification. So he was a depressed man. I mean, by the time he dies, he was an alcoholic.
By the time he died, he was banned. He was in Swaziland, banned in South Africa, meaning he couldn't publish anything in the country.
And he couldn't teach properly.
He couldn't teach.
Even though he had he was overqualified, so to speak. He couldn't earn. Drum was not giving him the positions he deserved. He worked, but nobody wanted him to be at the editor.
Yeah, he was the associate editor.
For Yonks.
He would be acting. He was acting editor three times, and they would bring an editor from the UK, from London. So when the editor is not there, he's the one holding the fort. And then when the editor comes,
European editor for a black publication.
So he would have to teach every editor that arrives. And obviously, Drum covered township stories, witchcraft, soccer, boxing, beauty pageants, and those white editors from the UK knew nothing about township life. So he was still the editor, even though he was not paid accordingly.
Yeah, I know. I remember. You know, I mean, even the way Spiva wrote the House of Truth.
Yeah.
And one experience that I lived was how life had dealt him
a bad hand. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And when he basically, like, you know, degenerate into the whole drinking, you know, I mean, for me,
And remember that Ken Tembati didn't want to leave South Africa.
This is it.
He tried to stay as long as he could until he could not work anymore.
Yeah.
He had lost his job at Drum. He could not teach.
And lost the love of his life because she leaves.
Yep. Mm. You know, so that's when he he decided to go to Swaziland. And even going to Swaziland shows that he didn't want to be
far away from home. Yeah.
You know.
Mm. And then he dies over a heartache.
Poetic.
Yep.
I think as a writer, there was something in his own writing. I mean, a lot of his writing was quite tragic, actually, which mimics how his own life ended, and how his life was, actually, more than anything.
Well, I think the most important thing is that he left a legacy. The sword is still here today. That's why we're having this discussion. And I think it's a privilege for me to finally see Brasillo performing the original version. Mm-hmm. I missed it in 1994 when he was performing at the National Arts Festival. Well, I didn't have the 10 rand. That was the first time I actually saw him, Brasillo, in person, walking to the drama department at Rhodes University.
This is okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but I didn't have money to see the show. Mm. So it's such a privilege that I get to see it 30 years later.
It was interesting that I think before you, not enough was gathered about him. There was this assumption. People just, threw his name around, Ken Temba, but not enough was gathered about his life.
Mm.
Did he not teach Tutu, Desmond Tutu?
Yeah. I was shocked actually to find out that there was not much written about him as a person.
Mm.
And in my research on him, I realized that much as we enjoy his stories, and he was so well known as a journalist, but part of his legacy was that of being a teacher, that he had taught people like the late Archbishop Tutu. He had taught Casey Mutsisi, who himself ended up becoming an iconic journalist. One of the people who are still alive, whom he taught, is Ndade Sol Rashilo. Obviously, there are many others.
Like, Joe Tolo was a mentor of his.
He mentored Joe Tolo. He mentored Jubi Mayet. He mentored Nat Nagasa. He mentored so many people. And even outside, you know, the newsroom or the classroom, he taught in his house of truth, because he converted his house as a space for intellectual debate, and that's where young people used to go for intellectual engagement.
Mm.
Yeah.
Gosh, the play is still on. Yeah,
the play is still on. And people must come and watch it or see it or come see me.
All I can say is that I've seen Brasillo on TV. I've seen him playing many other roles on stage. Mm. But if you want to see the best of him, you better see him in this version of the suit.
That is actually absolutely true. But if you are not going to go there for Achimo Roka, there is an old man called Mapikela.
Yeah.
And I think there's something beautiful about Ndata Silo spoke earlier about what the job of the actor is to do, is to breathe life into the words of these writers.
Mm.
And in a time where people don't necessarily consume literary texts as just that, people want to watch the movie of the book. I think coming to the theater is also such a mind-expanding experience. It lives in your body, in your skin, in your brain, in different ways. You experience, especially when you experience actors of this caliber, a story of this caliber, and South African creatives of the highest caliber. And I think it's like, it's just a service to ourselves to say we need to see each other shine. And this company shines in this work. And this writer's work shines in this work. And I think it's very important for us to patronize work like that.
The Suit by Ken Temba. It's on at Theatre on the Square until the 16th of November. That's it from me, folks. I'll be back tomorrow at 8.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.